This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Steve Jorgensen and for Independent Book Publishing. This is J. Douglas Barker. Today we visit with author Jill Watson Glasgow to discuss a book that she's written titled Secrets of Shiloh. Interesting title. It's a Westbo publication. Welcome, Jill.
Welcome to you. Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, tell me about this book. Is this an adult fiction, or what type of book is this?
No. This is a children's storybook. Well, more than a children's storybook, I like to call it a Christian storybook for families, because I found out that not only are children enjoying the story, but I've had comments, positive feedback from 8-year-olds to 80-year-olds. So this is a Christian storybook for families.
I fit in the middle of that. I could probably read that and understand it.
Hopefully so. I hope everyone would.
How many pages in this book?
The story itself is 44 pages.
And is this the first in a series, or are you planning to do more?
I hope to do more. This is actually second in a series of storybooks. The stories themselves are independent. They stand alone. But the format is one where there's reflection pages at the end of each chapter with questions and scriptures that can apply the spiritual truths that's been taught in that chapter. So I hope to use the same format to make a series of books that parents or grandparents or teachers could use with their children to help teach biblical truth.
And is that your motivation?
That is, but you know, I had never really dreamed of being an author. That was never one of my personal goals. So I really, truly believe this is an assignment from the Lord. It's kind of an interesting story if you would like to hear it.
Absolutely, love to hear it.
Well, 2 years ago exactly, I had heard a message by a young pastor that challenged the congregation just to go after the dreams that God had for you rather than us bringing our dreams to the Lord. And the next morning, I was sitting in my little rocking chair visiting with the Lord, as I do most mornings, and I felt like he said, it's time to write her story. And I knew exactly what he was talking about. My grandmother had been a teacher in the Tennessee Mountains in the early 1900s. And in 1955, she had written a personal letter describing her experience and expressing the hopes that someone in her family would write her story. And that letter had been passed down to me years ago. So I found the letter, and I just believed that the Lord said it was time to write her story. So I wrote the book, The Schoolhouse. But in addition to that, he led me to a scripture out of Exodus that says in chapter 10, you will be able to tell wonderful stories to your children and grandchildren about the marvelous things I am doing. So I just took that scripture as an instruction for me, keep writing as long as I provide the stories. And so after the release of The Schoolhouse, my daughter lives 500 miles away, and so she initiated a Build-A-Story game just to help us stay connected. So for the story of Secrets of Shiloh, I took parts of that unfinished narrative along with just family stories that we have and created this second storybook, Secrets of Shiloh.
And what significance is the term Shiloh to this book?
Well, I can't tell, because this is a mystery, and you're going to have to read the story to find out, because that's really one of the clues. As it's a story about two children that they have a special friendship with an old World War II veteran, and he lives on a plantation in South Alabama, and they go to this plantation, and he plays games with them. He creates war games and scavenger hunts to help the children develop problem-solving and critical thinking. Well, as the years pass and the children become teenagers, this beloved friend passes away, but he leaves a mysterious letter for Rachel that she doesn't understand. But Martin figures out that the letter's in encryption. In other words, embedded within the letter are clues for their last mission at Shiloh. And Shiloh is a biblical term, and it all ties in together, but I'm not going to tell you the secret of what that means exactly.
You're going to make me read that, aren't you?
I hope so. I hope many will read it.
Tell me about the other aspects of your book. At the end of each chapter, you have some, would you call them exercises? How would you describe that?
Reflection pages. The first book, when I had written The Schoolhouse, when I sent it to an editor, she just recommended, she said, you know, this seems like more of a good material for a children's book. And so I took that manuscript and rewrote it to be a storybook for children. And I believed at that point that the Holy Spirit guided me. He said, now, at the end of each chapter, add reflection pages with questions that will tie the story, you know, and be personal application for the reader as well, and tie them in to scripture that will teach a biblical truth. So each chapter of the story teaches a biblical truth, and at the end of that chapter, there's questions and scriptures to help the reader learn that biblical truth also. And then there's also a section at the bottom for journaling or just to write their thoughts back to God. And so the three categories in each reflection page, there's points to ponder with the questions, and then there's pearls from God's heart to your heart, and then finally there's petitions from your heart to Jesus, just to make this a personal thing. And I've just found it works so well when families do it together, parents with children, grandparents with children. I actually used it in a small group I was leading this summer and read a chapter to the ladies, and then we would discuss the questions at the end of each week, and it took 7 weeks because there's 7 chapters, and it worked really well. They seemed to really enjoy it, and just the way Jesus used parables to teach us things, that I hope that this is kind of a modern day parable that God can use to teach us the wonderful truth from His Word.
And what do you want readers to take away from this work?
Oh, the most important thing is how valuable each one of them is to God, and how important a personal relationship is with Him. I really believe that He designed this book, as well as hopefully future books, as tools to draw people who He loves very much closer to Himself.
Is there a particular scene or passage that stands out to you as the author?
Well, I'll just give a little snippet here, and hopefully we come in. This is in chapter 2, and the young girl's name is Rachel, and she's a child, and this is her first visit to the Shiloh plantation. And so I'll pick up in chapter 2. She found a stepstone path that led to a small fish pond and paused to watch iridescent orange goldfish weave gracefully in and out of their lily pad palace. A toad croaked loudly and with one hop disappeared under a display of concentric rings dancing across the water. Rachel followed the pathway that ended at a gazebo in the center of the lovely rose garden. Under the shelter's cedar-shingled roof hung a face-to-face bench swing. Colonel Hamilton stood behind the gazebo, carefully pruning a pink and yellow peace rose, and didn't seem to hear Rachel approaching. "You sure do spend a lot of time cutting things off your trees and bushes," Rachel commented. "Oh, hi, Rachel. Pruning the branches supports fresh new growth by removing the damaged or dead parts. It makes the plants stronger and healthier, and it helps them produce more flowers and better fruit," he explained. "We're like plants in a way," he continued. "Sometimes God prunes us back to help us grow and be fruitful. But unfortunately, we often don't understand the value of His work until it's too late." "Did you learn that in the Army, too?" Rachel asked. "No," the colonel answered softly. Looking over Rachel's shoulder toward the apple orchard, he said, "Shiloh taught me that lesson." Two lonesome hearts began to fill with a beautiful friendship on that pleasant Alabama afternoon. Rachel loved following the colonel around Shiloh and watching the old man tend to his flowers and fruit trees. He listened attentively to the young girl's chatter and patiently answered her countless questions. And I'll stop right there.
Well, you've got my attention.
Well, you'll just have to get you a copy.
So, well, I do have a copy. I haven't had the opportunity to read it as yet. I am planning to do so. Beautifully illustrated, too, I might add.
Yes, that has been one of the most exciting things to me and thrilling, that the award-winning artist Donnie Finley, he's also from Birmingham, and he illustrated Secrets of Shiloh. And after I had finished the first book and started the second book, just felt like it was an Alabama story, so would love to have an Alabama artist. And Donnie Finley attends the same church that I do, but I never dreamed that he would even consider illustrating this book, because his paintings have been used for well-known artists such as Max Lucado and Elizabeth George. But I had prayed and I asked the Lord, I said, could you please lead me to an exceeding abundant, above all I can ask or think, artist to do these illustrations and just bring this book alive. So one Sunday I asked Donnie, could he recommend someone to paint the illustrations for Secrets of Shiloh, and without hesitation he said, I would love to do it myself. And I was just blown away at the gracious way that God had answered that prayer. So even if you don't read the story, you just need to get the book to see these beautiful illustrations. They're just outstanding. And he used scenes from my city of Birmingham. The little church, Liberty Chapel, that's in the story, is a small church in our community, and there's just other things that people from the Alabama area may recognize, and they may even recognize some of the people, because he used people from our community as models for the pictures.
In addition to the spectacular illustrations and excellent writing, what sets this book apart from the others in the marketplace?
Well, I think it's just a unique blend. It's a good story. It's a fun story. I hope that people will just really enjoy the story itself and the beautiful watercolor artwork. But the spiritual teaching tool, I think, is what really sets it apart, that appeals to a wide range of ages. It can be a family devotion tool. It could be a small group discussion instrument. And when my children were younger, and my children are all grown now, and I have grandchildren, but we started a family devotion time when they were babies. And by the time they were in middle school, we were just desperate for good material that would be engaging, to keep their attention, to want them to stay in the Word of God, and it was difficult to find such material. And my husband has come in and he said, we would have loved to have books like these when our children were growing up. So I just want it to be an accessible tool for families all over the world, not just in the United States.
And is there anything about this book that was challenging to write?
There was something very, very challenging. After the release of The Schoolhouse, its publisher closed shop. It went out of business, and so I was left with a mountain of books to sell and kind of an orphaned author. And at that time, I was writing Secrets of Shiloh, and the thought just went through my mind, I just need to stop this and just give up and quit. But I didn't, and I'm so thankful, because, you know, God is such a master at working good things from challenges. And I had contacted the mother publishing company over this small publishing company that I had used, and they were very gracious, and they just sent ideas from their marketing team. And one thing they suggested was some type of social media, just to get the word out there that there was a book called The Schoolhouse at the time. And so I started a blog called wonderfulfamilystorybooks.blogspot.com. And after 2 weeks, I'd pretty much run out of things to say about one little children's storybook, and it developed into a devotional site. And so 5 days a week, I just put a devotion, and it's now being viewed in over 60 countries around the world, and it's just given me an opportunity just to connect with people in other countries, other continents, and just to share with them the Word of God, our own experiences, how God, your funny things, challenging things, and God truly has worked good from that challenging situation.
That's an amazing story. Certainly encouraging to others out there who may be struggling either with life challenges or perhaps an author who's finished a book, can't get it published, can't get it distributed. Wonderful story.
Well, the most important thing, I believe, is every day to spend time with the Lord and listen to His voice. Our part is really easy. You know, He has the plans. He has the instructions. If we'll just sit before Him, hear His instructions, and then walk in faith and obedience and do what He tells us to do, it's just unlimited what can be accomplished. And not to give up unless He says to, unless He says, okay, stop this, I've got something else for you to do. But as long as He's given you the instructions, then just to follow through. And then so often, it's just a biblical principle, you'll see throughout Scripture that before a vision was fulfilled, it died. You know, before Joseph was the prince of Egypt, he was in a prison as a prisoner. So it's just to persevere and follow what the Lord has for us to do each day.
Thank you, Jill. That's encouraging words. The book title again is Secrets of Shiloh, beautifully illustrated. The author, Jill Watson Glasgow. Thank you, Jill. Where can we get a copy of your book?
You can go to Amazon.com or BarnesandNobles.com, and hopefully it'll be in stores soon.
And give us the name of your blog spot again, or your website.
WonderfulFamilyStorybooks.blogspot.com.
Thank you. For George Stevenson, Independent Book Publishing, and Westbow Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing. And we'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, everybody. This is Pete Dix of Beatles and Beyond. Why don't we all come together and hear some of the tracks off the latest Beatles release on this radio station? Yes, why don't you look up the schedules on this radio station and join me and Beatles listeners everywhere to hear the latest releases from the Beatles on Beatles and Beyond with Pete Dix.
Connect with Juliana and connect with what lies beneath. Friday afternoons at 4, 3 Central on TogiNet.com. Juliana is a marriage, family, and child therapist who wants people to connect. Connect with what lies beneath, those truths and answers. And through her counseling practice, she has helped others find their personal power and fulfill their dreams. And she wants to do the same for you. Here on Connect with Juliana. Through intimate discussions, intriguing subject matters, and the expertise of her guests. For more on the show and Juliana, check out her webpage. Connect with Juliana in media.com. Juliana will cover it all. Nothing is off limits. She wants to know what matters to you. Make the connection. Tune into TogiNet to connect with Juliana to find out the facts that could be hidden beneath the surface. Connect with Juliana on TogiNet to make a quality connection in your life. Friday afternoons at 4, 3 Central on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings, this is J. Douglas Barker, and for Steve Jorgensen and Independent Book Publishing, we will be discussing a book titled The Circle of Management, Retail Facilities Maintenance. Our author is Al Tierney. This is a Westbow publication. Welcome to the program, Al.
Thank you very much, Jay. Nice to be with you.
Over 30 years of experience in multiple facilities management positions, is that correct?
Actually, 40 years of work experience, but I got into the retail facility maintenance line of it and have 30 years experience with that.
And were those wholesale outlets or were they retail?
No, mainly with the two companies, Granger and Bridgestone, both retail companies.
Those are certainly some large corporations. What motivated you to begin putting this book together?
Well, I retired from Bridgestone at the end of last year, 2012, and wanted to start a consulting company, not to keep as busy as I had been, but just to keep active. And one of the companies that I worked, that worked for me actually, suggested that when I had a little time to write a manual for their project managers on the management needed to perform well for corporate retail facility maintenance customers. So as I started that project, it hit me that why don't I look at the management aspects of all parties interested in corporate facility maintenance. So kind of broadened that whole project and outspit this book.
What would you call the circle of management? What would that entail?
Well, the circle of management is it encapsulates all of the interested parties in corporate retail facility maintenance. Certainly, you have management, the president and the COO and the CFO of the corporation, who are going to give you guidance as to what they want done. Certainly, you would hope that they would ask for your feedback in the process. And then you have the operations group, which is the store managers and all their management teams. They're going to let you know what the needs are, and then they're certainly going to tell you what the results of the maintenance you did for them. And then there is the inner circle, part of the circle, is the facility maintenance team that is the application of what's done to service their needs. And then you have the performance of the work. That's the vendors that are hired by the facility maintenance team to do all of the work. So it's really a circle of all those facets of people that make up what's needed to have your maintenance program done correctly.
And that incorporates some basic things like HVAC equipment, parking lots, roofing, things of that nature.
Yes, it does. Your electrical, the painting, everything you need to do to maintain your facilities and the property.
And what would you say was the key thing that you'd like your readers to take away from this work? Who is your target audience?
Well, the target audience is certainly the facility maintenance people who either had a career or have a career in facility maintenance now, or who are starting a career or wanting to get a career into it, to understand all the facets of management that is in that career. And then also the vendors, all of the companies that provide the services, the roofing and parking lot and HVAC and electrical and all of that, for the corporate facility maintenance team. There's a large portion in the book there about management concerns that they should have. And then we touch on the concerns of upper management, the direction that they give, and then also the operations people. They would have an interest, I think, in reading the book, because they're the people that want the work done, and they'll tell you what their thoughts were about the work that was performed. So there's a lot of people that have a concern with corporate facility maintenance, and it touches on all those groups.
Now, somebody who currently is not in facilities maintenance, but has certainly been around people like that, is this book going to be difficult for me to comprehend?
I don't think so. Some of it gets into some minutia on reporting, and for somebody outside of facility maintenance, they might find it hard plowing through. But for the most part, no. I've been told by other people who were outside of facilities who read it and found it somewhat of an easy read.
And you've managed to put this together in about 160-some pages. Is that an accurate description?
Yes, it is.
Is there anything in the book that would be termed or looked at as controversial in your assessment of management and the circle of management?
I wouldn't maybe use the word that, but I would say that some of the key areas that we touch on in the management aspects is the type of management of facility maintenance that is the best, that being predictive and preventive. We do explain that type of maintenance pretty much in detail and compare it against fix it when it breaks thought and the combination of the two. Also, there's another area in facility maintenance. When do you repair something versus replace something? And there needs to be guidelines on making that proper decision so you're not wasting money. And we have an area in the book on that with a chart and whatnot to help you make that determination. And then also with the vendors, how should they function with a facility maintenance team at a corporation in terms of managing their contractors and subcontractors, and we touch a good bit on that, how they have to take ownership and provide project management and good oversight of the people they hire, because the facility maintenance people are talking to their coordinators, their project managers directly, and then they have to turn around and hire, in some cases, subcontractors who we're not talking to. So it's very important that the vendors realize that they have a major project management component to make sure that the performance is done correctly.
And your years of facility management and observing others who were in leadership, what do you think makes a good leader?
Well, I think you have to certainly be competent, and you have to care. You really have to care for the store managers. They have a lot of pressure on them to succeed in sales. And there's a lot of other areas in the company that help them with sales. But if the building's falling apart around them or different components aren't functioning properly, you really need to care for the store manager and know that you're servicing the store manager, and to know that the store manager and their bosses, they are our customers. And we have to do everything we can to service them. So I think those are two main things that you're going to need to have.
Is there a correlation between talent and skills?
Well, skills, yes. You have to be a certain type of person that is customer service oriented. If you're not customer service oriented, then this is not the career for you, either as a facility maintenance person or as a vendor that's doing the work. You have to be customer service oriented. Then once you have that personality or skill set in terms of communicating and caring and listening, then your talents can click in to have heard them right, to know what's right to do, and then have all those different components of vendors and reports and what have you to get it done.
And this book, who's your target audience? Who do you think would benefit most from reading this book?
Well, I certainly would like facility maintenance people to read it, because as I say in the beginning and then at the epilogue, I look at this as a whiteboard process. You know, I when I retired, I sat at home and I thought, wow. It was like taking a long, long roller coaster ride, and the ride came to an end, and I went, boy, is that it? Do I leave everything that I learned along that journey? Is it, you know, go with me? And I, thankfully, this president with this company gave me this task that led me to write this book, and I really appreciated it because it allowed me to whiteboard, so to speak, some concepts of management here that the industry of facility maintenance should discuss, because we need to get a clear message to upper management as to predictive and preventive maintenance, repair, replace, what's the proper bidding processes. There's some things that we should have clear definition on and be able to communicate to upper management so that upper management can make the right decisions on maintenance and value having a qualified, talented facility maintenance director in their company to take care of this important part of their business.
Any particular challenges in writing this book?
Well, I've never written a book before, so I guess staying on task and getting it finished and realizing as I got it published just the process you need to go through to get a book published. I'm more of a like to get it done quickly. And you need a little patience.
How much patience did you need to get it finished?
More than I normally have.
How long did it take?
Well, the book took about 5 weeks to write, but then it took a number of months to work through the different steps within the publishing company to get the book published.
I think it's amazing that you accomplished this in 5 weeks. Regardless of your background, that's still an amazing accomplishment.
Well, you know, when someone asks me how long did it take you to write, I kind of, you know, half-kiddingly say it took 30 years.
That's true. It did. If you were going to share this with someone, how would you introduce the book?
I guess I would say that it's, as it says on the cover here, it's a narrative. And certainly there are people in the industry that know this as well as I do, or in some cases better than I do. But I had an opportunity working with two companies. The first company, Grainger, who asked me, the operations people came to me and asked me to put together a budgeting process that they would know what the costs are year in and year out. So you had to be predictive and preventive with it. And that was a unique challenge. That's not normative. It wasn't normative at the time. I think that the industry is moving more and more that way, but it wasn't normative. And then when I went to work for Bridgestone, they wanted to develop a predictive and preventive plan. So I had the opportunity to put in place that which I learned and put in place at Grainger. And so I worked with two very good companies and had two very good opportunities on a countrywide basis to develop this predictive and preventive model. And I basically wanted to share that with the industry and really open up dialogue with the industry to get together a clear, concise, predictive and preventive paper that our industry could give to upper management. So the facility maintenance people that are out there now would have some information that they could give that would help them better to move their companies to doing it right.
Sounds like the content would be good for small, medium, or large companies.
Yes, you're right, Jay. It would.
Very good. The book, again, is titled The Circle of Management, A 30-Year Experience Management Narrative. Our author, Al Tierney. Thanks, Al, for joining us today.
Thank you, Jay.
And where can we get a copy of your book?
Well, I have a website, www.facilitymaintenancemanagement.com. There'll be a blog on there and a little information about the book, and you can order there. Certainly, the book is also offered at Amazon.com and can be ordered at your local bookstore.
Thanks again. For Steve Jorgensen, Independent Book Publishing and Westbo Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Helen Wu was born and raised in San Francisco's Chinatown, and after a very difficult upbringing, fighting depression, abuse, and addictions, she finally finds herself genuinely happy inside and out. Helen believes in taking our positive thinking and doing something positive to achieve a positive outcome. She's here to make a positive difference in your life, to be your game changer, your aha moment mentor. She's ready to help both men and women get into a better place. Helen Wu is also the author of Self-Aid Success Stories, 25 Success Stories from Successful Entrepreneurs. Inspired by Ellen DeGeneres, Helen wants the world to know that just because we find ourselves in a difficult situation doesn't mean we have to stay there. We can aid ourselves to a better life. So join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Steve Jorgensen and Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book is titled Parroting, A Highly Sensitive Child, and the author, Julie B. Rosenshein. Welcome, Julie. Is this a book about food allergies, or is it a book about something else?
Well, actually, food allergies could be considered one type of sensitivity. And in reality, in my book, I look at four different kinds of sensitivities that a child can fall into, different categories.
Julie, your background encompasses a wide range of experience, including that of a school social worker, a psychotherapist, public speaker, and a lot of other areas, specializing specifically in treating highly sensitive children. Explain this book. What motivated you?
Sure. What motivated me with this book is that I saw in my private practice that I had families that were coming to me, and parents seemed to be having questions and challenges in the same areas while parenting their children. They would ask the questions, why is the child so sensitive? what their teacher can't seem to help them through their day. They're melting down. They're having tantrums. There's a lot of anger and anxiety. And my child, I've tried everything, and I don't know what it is. They want to label the child ADHD, but I don't really think that that's exactly what it is. And so I was seeing a lot of these parents were coming with the same kinds of questions. And I, in seeing these children, seemed to find that there were commonalities and categories and symptoms that they were all experiencing. So I wanted to write a book that would help parents have a guidebook in knowing what kinds of solutions were available to these kinds of kids.
How would you describe yourself as a child? Were you considered sensitive?
Yeah, I was considered sensitive, only they didn't really have the wording then. I think now pediatricians are even seeing that there is such a thing as high sensitivity as a trait, and also in physical terms. I was very sensitive emotionally, very sensitive to sound, noise, crowds, fluorescent lighting. I got headaches and migraines from certain types of lights. And I definitely had sort of an intuitive giftedness that was there from a young age.
And was that an emotional sensitivity primarily, or was it something else?
Well, I seem to know things before they happen. They seem to know things about people that I didn't know how I knew them, but I just knew things about people that were true. And it was kind of an intuitive gift and also a very sensitive heart. So I worried about the animals on the planet, and I worried about endangered species, and I thought about people who were less fortunate. I had a very sensitive heart, and my emotions and my feelings were very large. So self-regulation and emotional regulation was a hard thing for me as a kid.
Did you feel like this was something different than compassion?
Yeah, I do think it was different. It seemed to be that I had the kind of temperament that always wanted to help the less fortunate and was always thinking about other people's feelings. Most kids are playing on the playground, they're not thinking about those kinds of things in the same deep and meaningful ways that I was.
In your book, Home Sweet Home is one of the chapters, and it says this: the home of a highly sensitive child needs to be a safe haven, set apart from the overly stimulating outside world. These children need to be able to have a retreat where they can rest, discharge energy, connect with structure, and find safety. What is a highly sensitive child in your evaluation?
In my opinion and evaluation, highly sensitive children are really divided into four kinds of sensitivities. First of all, there are physically sensitive children who, I think I spoke a little bit about, that they're sensitive to sight, to sounds, noise, crowds, lighting, electronic equipment. They hate the tags in their clothing. They're sensitive to textures. They're the kind of kids that need just right for everything. They startle very easily. They're very sensitive to doctor's appointments and what happens at the dentist. And they notice very slight things in their environment. And many times these kids are allergic to cleaning products or to foods. And those are the kinds of kids that are physically sensitive and sometimes even labeled ADHD.
Are you addressing the symptoms of ADHD in your practice? How do you deal with that? How do you address that with families?
Well, usually I see that when a child is diagnosed with ADHD, they have the symptoms of inattention or hyperactivity, that those symptoms are caused by highly sensitive triggers that need to be balanced out. And when those triggers are balanced out, the child isn't hyperactive or inattentive anymore. So you can really solve those symptoms of hyperactivity and inattention by solving the underlying sensitivities that might be troublesome.
Do you personally prefer medication, or have you come up with some other solutions that work well?
I think medication has its place I think it's the last stop on the bus. I think there are a lot of other things that you can do before medication is tried. Some children get on medication, and it seems like it's the jigsaw puzzle that's missing. Most of the kids that I see have already tried medications and either found the side effects intolerable, did not want to be taking medicine, or found that the medication wasn't really touching the issues that they needed help with. In any case, any of the kinds of things that are in my book, The Tools and Tips, can be used with medication for an even greater benefit. And we see also that there are, you know, emotionally sensitive children that, we talked a little bit about this, but I see that there are kids that have frequent mood swings, crying jags, meltdowns. They sometimes are diagnosed with bipolar disorder or mood disorders. They have tantrums. They are really very charged, and they pick up on other people's energy sometimes. So these kids have a real problem with emotional regulation. And mostly it's because the kinds of places that they spend most of their time, which many times it's school, that's the biggest trigger for them, and the most sensitivities they find happening when they're around other kids is because they have such a sensitive emotional system that they're picking up on those other children's moods and sensitivities themselves. So they need real help in finding balance with their feelings, identifying their feelings, discharging their feelings, and knowing how to process the energy that's going through their bodies.
Well, explain the four types of highly sensitive children that you have discovered in your practice.
Sure. The first two we really talked about, the physically sensitive child and the emotionally sensitive child. The third one is really the spiritually sensitive child, and that's where this term many people have heard it used, although it's gotten to be a little bit harder to understand these days. But the spiritually sensitive child is what some people refer to as the indigo child, and that is a kind of child that is spiritually sensitive. They have spiritual gifts such as maybe being psychic, being able to know things and not know why or how they know them about people. They can sometimes see the aura or the colors around a person's body that shows their energy system. They sometimes can see angels or sometimes even see or hear deceased loved ones that they've never met before in their lives. And they have strong energy. They have difficulty sleeping due to sometimes night terrors or even past life recall, which not everybody believes in, but that's okay, because if you're the parent of a spiritually sensitive child, you'll know that this is the kind of child that you have. The fourth characteristic or category that I look at is the socially or transitionally sensitive child. And this is the kind of child that has problems transitioning from one task to another, or getting ready or stopping one task and, you know, listening so that they can hear what the next instruction might be at school. They have social anxiety, sometimes with making and keeping friends. They tend to avoid sleepovers or parties or social functions. They're very affected when their routine changes, like the change of a season, or if they go on vacation, or even at school when there's an assembly and the school schedule changes. These are the kinds of kids that get very anxious and sometimes are even labeled with generalized anxiety disorder.
Is it possible that they are, by heritage and by perhaps birthright, do they come from a family that's very highly structured in their thinking?
Could be. I mean, nature versus nurture. All sorts of family system issues factor into how these children are. But I would say that part of it is their parenting or their family issues. And then another part of it is an anxiety that you just can't quite put your finger on that seems disproportionate to what the situation is.
Just something that's there.
Yeah, exactly.
This book, is it complicated? Am I, as a parent, going to have difficulty reading and understanding your concepts? Who's it designed to appeal to?
This book, the thing that I have heard the most from people who have read it have said, I sat down in one session and read the whole thing. I didn't put it down. It is an easy read, mostly because I know, especially parents of these kinds of kids, don't have time. They're overwhelmed, overscheduled, over everything. And the last thing a parent needs is a complicated read that's going to take them a long time to finish. The other thing about this book that's special is that all of the tips and tools at the end of each section are things that I have done with children in my own practice. They're hands-on, they're tried and true tested. So it's not like I'm speaking in research terms or with big words. I'm giving parents the kinds of information that they need that I know works. And it takes years and years of working with these kinds of children to know what are the solutions that are really going to bring balance into the family system and also help these children function better in the world.
I'm glad to hear there are some solution-based answers in your book. That's certainly a very vital part of any discovery process and growing healthy children.
Sure, and nobody needs another large, fat book that doesn't really give them answers. People are looking for answers, and that's mostly the kinds of people who come to me are either teachers or parents who they've tried everything else and nothing has worked. So they need something that's going to be an answer to some of the challenges they're facing with their children. I tend to help people with the kids that nobody else knows, you know, quite what to do with challenging behaviors, with mood swings, with some of the sensitivities we talked about. And also, sometimes children are misdiagnosed with ADHD and given stimulant medication that's not really working, and the parent can't figure out, well, what else could I do? Why isn't this working? And so I look at it from a little bit of a different paradigm, and then when we shift gears and we try to keep the visual stimulation down and we try to get the kids back outside more and we pare down on the technology that they're using, there's all sorts of hands-on tools that can be helpful, especially if medication isn't working and other strategies tried are not really producing results.
Do you think that's what sets this book apart from the rest that are out there in the marketplace?
I think so. I'm looking at it from a little bit of a different perspective, and I'm seeing ADHD from a little bit of a different perspective. I see inattention and hyperactivity as symptoms of a more underlying cause, and that underlying cause is a high sensitivity. And I really do think that there is a place for medication, but in our society and in the United States specifically, I think we have a lot of over-medicated kids that really need other kinds of solutions that can work.
Are there a growing number of children who fall into this category? Is it leveled out?
Growing numbers.
Well, what do you think is driving that number?
I think what's driving the number of kids that seem to be more sensitive these days is that there's more toxicity in the environment that's affecting their bodies. So now that we're seeing that there's more pollutants, there's more change to our environment, there's things in the earth that are triggering their sensitivities, I think these children have little bodies that are being affected in big ways by the current events happening on the planet right now. I think a lot of the violence that they see in video games and on the TV screen and on the news is part of a problem. I think that the kinds of food they're eating is they're less able to get the nutrition they need. And I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, there was no such thing as a peanut-free half of a cafeteria,
mm-hmm,
or two tables where kids couldn't peanuts. You know, now you see this is such a problem where, you know, there are children who could conceivably be brought to a hospital or die if they are even exposed to peanuts. That wasn't something I saw as a child, and I bet you haven't either.
I did not.
These kinds of sensitivities are getting, more and more common as children's bodies are being bombarded with some of the toxins and the allergens that are on the planet now. It's a more complicated time to live.
It definitely is. In fact, as an adult, I have experienced some of that same allergies and difficulty because of the environment and also the foods, how they've been modified.
Absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up, the GMO and the way that the wheat has been modified. Now, to me, it seems that as an adult, I've now decided that wheat, gluten, and sugar is not something that my body can even process well.
And so we're on the same page.
So it's interesting when a child comes to me and the parents are saying tantrums, rages, and can't sleep at night, I say, what are they eating? And I know if I had a nickel for every parent that's going to say they're eating pasta, they're eating bread, they're eating pasta, they're eating bread, they're eating chicken nuggets, they're eating nitrate-filled luncheon meats, I know what they're eating is affecting them.
Absolutely.
We've known this for a long time. It's surprising to me that nobody's really getting on board with this. But genetically modified foods, there's so much that's being changed in the preservatives and the additives and the way foods are being packaged. So I'm a big proponent of protein and vegetables.
I like that. My wife and I travel to Europe, and we don't have the food allergy reactions that we have in the United States and Canada. So it is prevalent here.
Isn't that amazing?
Mm-hmm.
I tell people, try to shop at places, if you can, like Trader Joe's, where most things are not from the United States, because we put more junk in our food than probably any other country on the continent.
I agree, Julie. Thank you so much. The book, again, is titled Parenting, The Highly Sensitive Child, and we've been visiting with author Julie B. Rosenshine. Thank you, Julie, again for visiting with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And how can we get a copy of your book?
You can just order it on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, or BalboaPress.com.
Do you also have a website, by any chance?
Sure. My website is WholeChildAndParent.com. And they also have a Facebook page. You can look under Help Your Highly Sensitive Child Thrive.
Very good. Thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
For Steve Jorgensen and Indie Book Publishing Balboa Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.